UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie and the Foreign Secretary William Hague live from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. Join them for Woman's Hour at 10 o'clock here on Radio 4. And now on Radio 4 FM, the Book of the Week. Rebecca Front continues reading from Curious, her collection of memories and observations that celebrates the idiosyncrasies of everyday life. Today, she looks back on her university years and recalls the exceptionally grotty state of her third-year student digs.
In our final year at university, a group of friends and I decided to live out of college. Most people used the third year as a chance to stand on their own two feet. I was 21, for goodness sake. It was high time I grew up. A bit. There were four of us in the household. Jane, Lou and me from one college, and a bloke called Steve, whom none of us knew. He had answered our ad on the risky assumption that sharing with three women might prove to be a more civilised affair than sharing with three other men. We were, every one of us, as guileless and naive as baby lambs. We didn't choose our flat. It chose us, as it was the only one we could afford. It consisted of two floors above an empty retail unit. You had to let yourself in through a door at the side, then walk down a dank passage into a courtyard filled with old electrical appliances, bits of scaffolding and other detritus. At the far end was a tumble-down shed, but if you turned back on yourself, a second key would let you enter the rear door. Once inside, you walked up a steep flight of stairs, covered, in a threadbare kind of a way, with a frankly hideous carpet. This same carpet ran throughout the flat. There was no escape from it. And, it turned out, no way of cleaning it. Things just sort of stuck to the surface. You couldn't remove them, and they were never absorbed. They just sat there until overtaken by some greater stain. One of the things we had all wanted was a communal area. We had a rosy vision of sitting around in our living room discussing the issues of the day over a glass of wine and maybe a nibble or two. This place had a living room, but it was so small and so dominated by the ghastly carpet, an unexplained smell, and a sofa which unquestionably had fleas, that we literally never used it. In fact, I barely crossed the threshold more than once, and only then because my boyfriend had parked his bike in it. Over the stove was a bare light bulb, and when it rained heavily, water would come through the roof, trickle down the live cable, and drip into whatever we were cooking. Jane raised this with our landlord, Mr. Wills, in a series of increasingly stiffly worded letters. She peppered them with references to Dickens and to Mayhew's London Labour and the London Poor, which we all felt were nicely apposite and couldn't fail to hammer the message home. But Mr. Wills seemed oddly impervious to her rhetoric, and we never got more than an empty promise to sort it out. There was a tiny bathroom on the main floor, and on the downstairs landing, next to the deserted living room, an additional toilet. Shortly after we moved in, Lou saw something in there that was at least a mouse and possibly a rat, and from that day onwards nobody ventured in. But we rarely complained about anything, other than the death trap kitchen light bulb, because we were trying to be grown-ups. We felt that we just had to get on with things. It was only when my parents brought Grandma Dolly up one weekend that we changed the way we looked at it. Grandma knew a thing or two about life at the bottom of the ladder, having started out in an East End tenement. So when she turned to my mother and said in a loud stage whisper, "Oh my God, she's living in a slum!" we finally realised Mr. Wills was ripping us off. We thought long and hard about this, talked late into the night about the injustice of preying on people's vulnerability, and debated the best way to make a stand. Finally, we took the decisive action of leaving things as they were and trying not to let it get us down. Mr. Wills, for reasons best known to himself, but which almost certainly included the words cheap, job lot and man in a pub, had fitted the flat with a musical doorbell with a repertoire of about 8 songs, all delivered with ear-splitting tinniness. One night, shortly after we'd gone to bed, The doorbell rang. I got up, fumbled around for my dressing gown and bumped into Lou in the hall. "Are you expecting anyone?" I asked. "No, you?" "No." The doorbell had finished its nasty performance by now, and we decided to ignore it and go back to bed. Moments later, though, it started again, playing a different tune. The others were up now, and we all went into my room, which overlooked the front door, to peer out. In the darkness, we could just about make out the top of someone's head. A man, we thought, with dark curly hair. "Maybe we should call the police. You can't dial 999 because there's someone at the door." "We could just answer it." "No, you don't open the door to strangers late at night. Do you?" The truth was, none of us had any idea about anything. Just months before, we'd had a college porter to handle such situations, and before that, our dads. It suddenly felt very scary to be a grown-up. It was Jane who thought of the answer. She opened my window and leaned out. We all crowded round her to take a look. "Excuse me," she called politely. "Do you want something?"
"Is Harvey there?" said the man.
"Harvey? No, sorry, you've got the wrong address." She closed the window. But the man didn't move. After a few moments, he rang the doorbell again. Steve was feeling brave. "I'll go and talk to him." "No," we all chorused. "You might get stabbed or shot." Steve opened the window. "Excuse me, mate," he called. Just because someone might want to murder you, there was no need to be impolite. "Could you stop ringing the doorbell, please? We're trying to get some sleep." The man slowly looked around, then up again.
"Is Harvey there?" he said again.
It was exactly the same inflection as the first time. There was no acknowledgement that we'd already covered this ground, and it made us think that perhaps he wasn't, as my dad would have put it, quite the full shilling.
"There isn't anyone called Harvey here, mate," said Steve gently. "You're ringing the wrong doorbell. Do you mind letting us get some sleep now?"
The man looked at him blankly.
"I'm looking for Harvey."
"Maybe you can call Harvey," I suggested, "and check the address."
"Harvey doesn't have a phone. That's why I've come round to talk to him."
"OK," I said. "But he doesn't live here, you see, so you can't talk to him. He lives somewhere else. Sorry." The man looked up at me for a minute, then slowly moved away from the door. We watched as he ambled off down the street. Then we all went into the fetid kitchen, made tea, and congratulated ourselves on clearing another of the hurdles adulthood was putting in our path. The next night, at around the same time, the doorbell began its endless toll again. We ignored it, and eventually it stopped. But the night after that, it happened again. By now, we were less scared and more determined to sort it out. All four of us went downstairs, through the passageway, and opened the front door. For the first time, we could see more of our visitor than just the top of his head. He was a chubby, short man in his 30s with a pleasant face. He certainly didn't look like a mass murderer, but then if mass murderers looked like mass murderers, the world would be a simpler and a safer place.
"Is Harvey here?" he asked,
as we knew he would. We took it in turns to explain to him as patiently as we could that there was no Harvey, and he'd obviously made a mistake. He looked at us calmly, blankly, but showed no sign of understanding or giving up. We told him that we were students, that we all lived together as friends, that we would know if there was anyone else living with us because it wasn't a very big flat. We explained about the musical doorbell and how we all had essays to write and it was disturbing us. We were floundering, vainly trying to make him understand a little about our lives and how difficult he was making things, but becoming uncomfortably aware how much more difficult his life must have been. Eventually, when our barrage of useless information stopped, he opened his mouth to speak. It was slow, as if he was trying to wade through a lot of muddy thoughts in his head.
"Harvey does live here. I've been here. I've seen him."
"Maybe it was a long time ago," suggested Lou. "Did Harvey live here before we moved in?"
"I don't know. Did you live here last week?" Yes, said Lou. Well, so did Harvey. We'd reached an impasse. Eventually I said, OK, well, look, Harvey isn't here, so I think you're going to have to go now. I'm sorry to be rude, but, you know. If it's possible to close a door in someone's face politely, then that's what we did. We walked up the stairs in silence and into the kitchen. I put the kettle on and Lou opened the cake tin. The doorbell rang again. I wonder if he'd like a scone, she said. A few moments later, we all stood on the doorstep again, watching him eat one. He told us his name was Paul. When he'd finished his scone, he asked if he could see Harvey now. He really isn't here, Paul, Jane said. Can I just have a look? He asked. And there was something so innocent in the way he said it that we stood aside and let him into the passage. I suppose we'd all come to the conclusion that even if he was dangerous, he was less likely to kill someone who'd given him a homemade scone. Paul walked straight through the passage and into the courtyard, but he didn't attempt to go through our back door. Instead, he crossed the yard and headed for the tumble-down shed. He knocked on the door. "Harvey, it's me, Paul!" he shouted. And to our amazement, the door opened and he went inside. It turned out Harvey did live there. He'd been there the whole time and we'd neither seen him nor heard him nor even spotted a light. We went upstairs to our flat and tried to get our heads around this curious development. How could we have been oblivious to another human being living in such close proximity? And if our place was squalid, how much worse must his have been? I got angry. I wanted to write a letter to Mr. Wills and ask him what he was doing, letting people live in sheds and not telling us. I don't think Mr. Wills knows anything about it, Jane said. I reckon Harvey's a squatter. We still didn't like the idea of this secretive stranger in our midst, but anyone who could put one over on Mr. Wills was worthy of our admiration. The fact is, Steve said thoughtfully, polishing off another of Lou's scones, he's been there all this time and he hasn't bothered us. We haven't heard a peep out of him. Really, you couldn't ask for a better neighbour. But it doesn't seem right for him, I said. This whole scenario brought out my suburban side. I mean, what must it be like in there? It can't be healthy living like that. But that's his choice, said Lou. It's not really any of our business. And I had to concede she was right. There didn't seem to be much we could do about it, and there didn't even seem to be a reason to try. Harvey stayed living in the shed for the rest of the year. We never found out how he got a key for the front door, and we never told Mr. Wills. Whatever his circumstances, we lived out the rest of our student days in parallel with him. While we were falling in love and rehearsing plays and cooking meals and studying for our finals, just across the courtyard, Harvey was in his shed, struggling through as best he could, with only Paul for company.
Rebecca Front was reading from her book Curious, True Stories and Loose Connections. The book was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And tomorrow at the same time, Rebecca Front continues to explore the quirks and idiosyncrasies of human nature when she reads the next instalment from her new book.
On BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are about to start our descent into
new writing. Short stories and seminal works.
Turner, it's Jack.
Can't be. Jack's dead.
Do I sound dead?
Starring Ian Glenn, Jessica Rain, Hayley Atwell and Derek Jacobi.
Ace! Ace!
Now we knew for sure we weren't alone. We almost wish we were.
Dangerous Visions begins on Saturday.
In a special broadcast of Women's Hour this morning, Jenny Murray talks to the UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie and the Foreign Secretary William Hague, live from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. Join them for Women's Hour after the news.